and also from the ITF in Utrecht. And today he tells us about time and quantum gravity as a stochastic time.
Okay, thanks for the introduction. Yeah, this is some work done with the people mentioned here, Renata Doll, Yoshi Lattepitti, and Dylan Destra, and Stefan Storm. So it's my main interest in quantum gravity goes these days in what is called causal dynamical triangulation, and this is what comes out of the two-dimensional version of this, where you can actually do analytic calculations. So I put here time. What is time? And of course, many people have thought deeply about time in general relativity. Much more clever people than me, so I'm not going to add anything to this. We know that, that time is a mysterious thing. Some even claim it's an illusion. That might well be. Sometimes I feel that. So if time is difficult to understand in general relativity, it's probably even more difficult to understand in quantum gravity, one would say. So I'll not take any philosophical attitude to this, but much more mundane attitude in terms of just basing this on calculations. So the answer of this calculation is that at least in 2D quantum gravity, what one would call quantum time is can be identified by the stochastic time, and I will explain in what sense. So of course, toy models of quantum gravity, they are just toy models, but still they might trigger new ways to think about time. And the two-dimensional toy models are in a way particularly nice because they still maintain most of the conceptual problems associated with time and with quantum gravity. And then they can be solved, and they don't know, they could also be misleading, of course, but they might highlight some non-trivial aspects of time. In much the same way as the Ising model highlighted the fact in the old days that one could indeed get non-trivial scaling exponents in quantum physics. And that was Ising model for the first time this was understood, that it's not just meeting exponents. And in a certain way, the fact that time, quantum gravity time, could be somewhat different from what we imagined, actually first came from these 2D toy models by the work of Kawai and Ishibishi, and also by myself and Lattepitti. And I will explain that on the way here. So CDT, causal dynamical triangulations, that's a way to provide a regularization of quantum gravity, and it might not give a number, it gives a number term, a definition of four-dimensional quantum gravity, whether this has anything to do with whether there exists something like quantum gravity. We don't know, strictly speaking, it gives a model of this, and it has some interesting features. I gave two talks about this a couple of months ago here, so I will not really enter into the higher dimension CDT, so I will I'll just stick to the two-dimensional. So what is special about this CDT is that it gives time a special role. I mean, the starting assumption is that we have a global time foliation of our quantum universe. So we can think about the time as one as some kind of proper time in the ADM decomposition. So I've written down here the ADM composition with the labs put equal to one, and there are various definitions of gauges here which has been used in trying to quantize two-dimensional completing kind of quantum gravity, also the Lorentzian, but usually one has made a rotation to Euclidean time here. But if this H is put gauge fixed to be only a function of time, then it's called temporal gauge. And if the shifts are put equal to, it's called proper time gauge. So this CDT way of discretizing space-time, making it into a lattice, is compatible with this temporal gauge choice here, if one wants to introduce kind of coordinate systems. But in principle, one doesn't have to do that in the CDT approach. I mean, the approach is just that you make a translation of space-time here, two-dimensional space-time, in terms of triangles. These triangles are fixed, they have a fixed shape, and you glue them together in all possible ways, compatible with a global time foundation. So I've shown here a configuration. Actually, this is a real configuration generated by computer simulations. So you have here the time slices here. So time is up here. And so you have here space is a circle. So you fix the topology of space, in this case to be S1. And then you have a time foliation. And so each space slice here consists of just a number of links. And then you connect each time slice in all possible ways. You can do triangles here. So these triangles are supposed to be identical in this representation. Of course, they don't look identical, but in the geometry, it's difficult to embed it then. So this is an embedding which distorts the different triangles. This is how a configuration would look like. And you now have a lattice cut off, the lattice spacing A. And in principle, this is a diffeomorphic invariant cut off of the zero. So the transition amplitude that we want to calculate is inspired just by quantum mechanics, ordinary quantum mechanics. So in ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we understand what time is, just ordinary Newtonian time. And we have the transition amplitude of, say, a particle going from xi to xf in time t. It's written as the sum of all trajectory here, going from xi to xf. And the action is just a classical action. So we want to repeat this construction now in case CDT. So we define what we call the transition amplitude. This is a function of the initial geometry, the spatial geometry, the final spatial geometry, and the time t. So exactly what is time here? So what we think about time here is just proper time. So this is a very this amplitude here is a very special amplitude in GR. You might wish to calculate many other amplitudes, but now we are choosing to calculate exactly this amplitude because it can be calculated. So what is special about this is that there is a relation between the emission and the final geometries in the following way, that each point here, this spatial effect, is can separate precisely a geodesic, a proper time t from the kind of initial geometry. So it is an object that we want to calculate. To define it, well, we need to define this particle in a specific way, exactly as we need to define the particle up here. So here you need to define it, and the way it's done in textbooks is usually that you slice the time in pieces, and then you connect the different parts as a piecewise linear path, and then you take this time slicing to zero. And what I want to do here is basically the same. So if you go back to the configuration here, so we want to take the lattice spacing to zero in this construction here, both in the time direction and in the space direction, the simultaneous. And so in general, the kind of definition, and this applies in any dimension, not only in two dimensions, but also in kind of D dimension, that that we have the spatial slice at in the beginning, ti. So this is triangulated with a triangulation of dimension d minus 1. And then we take all d-dimensional triangulated, so if it was four dimensions, it would be four synthesis. In two dimensions, it would be triangles, kind of connecting these two initial and final d minus one dimensional triangulations. And we sum over all such kind of configurations compatible with a time slice. And the action that we use is what is called a Ratchet action for piecewise linear geometries. So each of these geometries will be piecewise linear, and we sum all these. This is just a symmetry way it is put in. It's not important. Now, what is special here is that in the case of d equal to 2, one can actually solve this model. One can find these objects even at a digitized level before taking the limit a going to 0. Then one can explicitly take the limit a going to 0, and in this way one can obtain what we would like to call the continuum propagating. So this can be done explicitly, and one can understand how the critical limit is taken. I will not really discuss this here, but I will just give you the continuum result, because this is all work done by Renard and me kind of more than 10 years ago, that one could actually do these things in two dimensions. But before proceeding, let me highlight some of the CT virtues as a theory of quantum gravity. I will not tell you about the flaws, but that's certainly the virtues. So, in a way, no background geometry is put in by hand. The path integral is a sum over geometry, so no coordinates are needed here. It's a sum over geometry. And actually, the Anton-Hilbert action, which we will use, it has a natural realization of these linear geometries due to Ratchet. In two dimensions, this becomes kind of trivial because there is no Einstein term. So kind of basically, it's just a cosmological term. So, but in higher dimensions, one has this natural Einstein-Hilbert action on piecewise linear geometry. One has a diffeomorphism in the Rayon cutoff in the lattice. And actually, and this is important when we actually solve the model, each configuration we have created in CNC allows a natural rotation to Euclidean geometry. So that's what we will do when we solve the model. We rotate to Euclidean geometry, so we are summing all a class of Euclidean geometry. Formally, it corresponds precisely to this T going to IT. Then, in the end, we can rotate back again to Minkowski time, if you want to do that. For higher dimensional series, for two dimensional series, this is not an issue, but for higher dimensional series, this regularization automatically also acts as a regularization of the unboundedness of the Euclidean action if you use the Einstein-Hilbert term. And where the use of the path integral, of course, has some advantages in the sense that we can still use classical geometry and such concepts, even if you try to explore the meaning of a quantum geometry.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. Sir.
Like, is there a way in which you obtain like classical backgrounds from this, or the classical space?
Sure.
And if that's the case, then my next question would be: is there any does the slicing, the time slicing, cause any problems for local Lorentz invariants or something?
No, I can't think so. It will bring us a little bit far away to discuss this in detail, but in higher dimensions, what we have seen in the higher dimensional case, where we cannot solve the model and have to do numerical calculations, is that you get as a background, seemingly the classical solutions to the Euclidean Einstein equations that comes out as a background. But it's not put in by hand, it comes out as a solution around which the quantum propagations take place.
Can I have a question? If you have a path integral formalism, quantum field theory, Yang Mills, you need a measure. Measure is non-trivial. So how do you get a measure for geometries?
Well, the measure is here. So the continuum measure is here. but here it is actually very concrete. So it tells you that each geometry is summed with weight one, except for an intrinsic chi-symmetry factor. Except for an intrinsic chi-symmetry factor, which is also there in the continuum. So if you have Q-ring vectors and different symmetry, then you have to divide this out in the parsons. This is exactly what it says. So if you ignore that little subtlety, then each geometry appears with weight one.
Measure.
And that is, of course, exactly what you want to do in the kind of deep measure in principle.
So if you do something practical, like take a fixed background in Kosky space time and derive the Feynman diagrams in two dimensions, what would you get?
Well, that's exactly what we're not doing, because we want to solve this non-perturbative. So we're not doing that. But of course, in principle, you could try to do something like that. But then you could as well do continuous physics instead. So the idea here is supposed to do better than that, to define the Parsons kind of non-perturbative. So that's what we're doing.
And that question, what was the exact definition of this factor 1 over C sub T?
So what this is just the order of the automorphism group of the graph.
I see.
Basically. And then in
typically it's 1.
I'm sorry?
Typically it's 1, I suppose.
Yeah, sure.
It's almost always 1.
Yeah, it's almost 1 except for the special situation. Yes, absolutely. So see, I think it was not important, really. but now we have really talked about business. Well, as you also would expect, there will be no killing vectors for arbitrary geometry. Yes. So the only thing I want to say here is so when you rotate to make this rotation, then indeed this action goes, if you use the Ratty action for these piecewise linear geometries, it goes over exactly into minus I times the Euclidean action as you would expect. And the quantum amplitude goes to the partition function. And indeed, taking the partition limit, it means to study the critical behavior of the corresponding statistical system. And in higher dimensions, we have done this by Monte Carlo simulations. But here, we can solve explicitly, analytically. You can take the continuum limit, and I will just give you the result. So it's simply done by counting all graphs and summing them, and it's a combinatorial problem. It can be solved explicitly. So before showing you the kind of solution, let me just remark that since we are in two dimensions, the situation is very different from the four dimensional with that kind of quantum gravity. So I said that no background is put in by hand, but in fact, in two dimensions, there is no background. I mean, there is no action. I mean, the isohedral action is not there. Only the cosmological term is there. And in fact, if you have the time direction going this way, it's clear that the corresponding classical solution is just a line here with no volume, because the action is the cosmological constant times the volume. Clearly, the solution to this is the volume equal to zero, just a line connecting this. So what you see here is pure quantum fluctuations kind of around this line, because we have a quantum zero, and of course, it fluctuates. So this is well known. The 2D quantum gravity is pure quantum zero. So in this way, it is not a bad toy model for studying kind of quantum gravity. You will not study the quantum aspects of the graviton, for sure. But you will study the quantum aspects associated with diffeomorphism invariances when you study 2D. So the 2D solution of this two-point function is written down here. So this is after you put it on a lattice. You solve the explicit on the lattice, you take the lattice space into zero. Then the continuum objects which are left when you take this lattice space to zero is this propagator. So here's this proper time. C, it propagates a universe of links L to a universe of links L prime in proper time T. So when you are in two dimensions and you have a spatial slice, the only diffeomorphism invariant object there is the links. So the geometry is entirely characterized by the links. So that's why the links appear here. And it can nothing but the links. So two dimensions is very simple. So you can show that this this property is satisfied the following kind of differential equation, and it has this solution then. Clearly, this is the second order differential equation, and if you call this the Hamiltonian, then it has this solution here. It's like a Schrodinger equation, so it has a solution. And in fact, this in quotation mark Hamiltonian is Cartesian adjoint on this measure, and this measure here is the right measure to choose. I will not really give you the arguments, but it is really the right measure to choose. So you can, this is a simple Hamiltonian, so you can solve it.
Can you say in which sense this is purely quantum?
Well,
you rethink its purely quantum. Not here. I'm saying, if I look at the Hamiltonian here, yeah. Can you tell the same story?
No. I don't know what you mean by something is purely quantum when you have a Hamiltonian.
Well, it means that when h bar goes to zero, there's only, I don't know, the Hamiltonian is trivial. Or so can you? I'm just asking if you can if you can see the same story that you just said.
Yeah, well, in a certain sense, yes.
So
kind of clearly, there's only one coupling constant here. That's a cosmological term, constant. And if you take that to infinity, then let's go back here. So here are the solutions to this Hamiltonian, and you're seeing that so these are wave functions of the universe, you can say. So such a wave function would propagate undisturbed in shape. That's what it means to be an eigenfunction here, where it will give a kind of distribution here. So you see, if lambda goes to infinity, of course, this becomes just a line. So that is a classical solution to this. That look that Lokinidic term.
You're saying that if you put the h bar, you're saying the kinetic term goes to zero.
Well, there's one coupling constant here. So if you scale in h bar kind of correctly, it will combine with this coupling constant lambda. And when you put h bar to zero, there'll be effectively this term here. The universe will shrink to a point. That's the classical solution to 2D gravity if you only have the cosmological. Look, the action is just lambda. So in this way, it is pure quantum.
I understood the previous story. I'm just asking if you look at that, how can I see this story?
Yeah. So
I need to put the h bar somewhere.
Sure. H bar.
But it means that in the limit h bar goes to zero, the Hamiltonian goes to zero. Or?
Of course, the classical solution is a point universe of no extension. You have. The action is just lambda times the volume.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This Hamiltonian, they correspond a classical Hamiltonian, I'm saying, to that. So I'm just asking, what is this classical Hamiltonian corresponds to?
No. How you obtain that Hamiltonian?
I obtain it in the following way. That's why I said I called it the Hamiltonian in quotation mark. You can solve for this object here. So this is the amplitude propagating from L, an initial spatial universe of length L, propagates time t, and it ends up at length L prime. Now, so you can ask exactly what is governing this process of propagation, since there's no action in 2D. The thing which is governing this is entirely the entropy of the configurations. I mean, there's a number of, there are many configurations to propagate there, but no action. So it's entirely entropical phenomena. And
the theory of an effective Hamiltonian, which is LP squared plus lambda L. So you can construct an action from it. So
well, you can go back. You can
effectively there's an action.
You can go backwards and construct an action if you want to do that. It will just reflect the entropy of these configurations. So it's entirely kind of entropical. So kind of gravity here. And again, if you look at this graph here, so since we have already rotated to 2D space, we can think about it as statistical models. And of course, the actual shape of these things, how it fluctuates here, is of course entirely dictated by entropy. You have to count how many configurations are there in this way, and in this way you get an entropy. And of course, the classical solution will appear with probability zero. Of course, that's a very special configuration. So in general, so if you take the profile here, so it just follows the usual rules of kind of quantum mechanics. That's why I say quantum. So you start out with some initial condition here. Soon, this will be forgotten because we know the energy spectrum. So the ground state will dominate, and the shape here will exactly be the square of the. So the shape here is basically telling you, I mean, the length of the universe. And if you go to here, this length profile is given by the ground state is corresponding to n equal to 1 of this thing here. So this starts actually with L. So it will be L, and then this is squared. I'm sorry. This T should be an L. I'm sorry. This is a of course it should be an L. It's a L argument. So it should be an L. So. But this is entirely dictated by entropy of the configurations. The two-dimensional quantum gravity, once you have rotated to a Cartesian space, is entirely entropical.
Does the cosmological constant have to be positive in this analysis? Because you would get an imaginary.
Well, it has to be positive in the beginning because the model is not defined if you, I mean, as a sum. If you put it.
The sum
was yeah. After you have solved it, you can, of course, make a new constellation if you want. But we haven't really done that, but you could do that, yes.
Then it's not suppressed. Then it's purely oscillatory.
Yeah. Well, then I don't know. I haven't given any interpretation to that. But so you can define a Hartle-Hawking like wave function by letting the universe disappear at some point. So the exit loop is contracted to zero. So it disappears into nothing. And actually, so this is more or less well. In the Hartle-Hawking, you would like the universe to start here and then develop into this thing here. We do it the opposite way. It's more convenient for our kind of formalism. This satisfies H naught of W naught of L equal to zero. So it's like, so in this way, this so-called Hamiltonian, it acts exactly like the Hamiltonian you would like in quantum gravity, that this is the Villard-Levitt equation. You would think that exactly the Hartle-Hawking wave function satisfies this equation and this satisfies this equation. So this corresponds to energy equal to zero formally. But you see that actually it doesn't belong to the spectrum of H naught because the measure is given by this thing here. So it's not, this wave function is not integrable when we use this measure. Okay. So how was the model solved originally? Well, it was solved by entirely, as I said already, it was solved entirely by combinatorial lessons. And the way it was done was that a Laplace transform of this object was performed, well, at a discretized level here by doing it at the continuum level. So in a way, you can see that this function here is the kind of generating function of these numbers here. And these numbers, they were nothing. Well, they describe the propagation, but in terms of the path integral, since the weight is so simple there, then in fact, these numbers, they were nothing but the actual number, before we took the value of zero, they were nothing but the actual number of configurations. This was it. So this thing here was a generating function for these numbers. And in this way, when one solved it and counted these configurations, one could easily find this thing. And after that, one could kind of reconstruct this thing. So that was how the model was solved originally as a combinatorial model at the distance level, kind of before taking the space into zero. Now, I have now made, so since we know the differential equation of this, this function, we can of course Laplace transform it to get the equation satisfied by this function. In fact, historically, of course, we can derive this first because we calculated this first, but never mind. So it satisfies the following equation here. So I write it down because we will need it later when we discuss stochastic quantization. So this S in this particular model of CDT is a cubic potential. And we now have a kind of Hamiltonian here in X, which is written like this, where S is this kind of cubic potential. So this X was just a convenient variable, making it when you make the Laplace transform here, but you can also view it when X is real. You can view it as a boundary cosmological constant, because what have you added here? You have added an action, which is x times the length of the boundary. So that would be exactly the boundary cosmological term you would add to the action. So when x is real, it has the physical implication as a boundary cosmological constant. But of course, calculating first this object here and going back here, we have to make an inverse Laplace transformation, so we have to go out to kind of imagine that X is in order to do that. But when X is real, it has a physical implication like this. Now, so in this ADM decomposition, which was behind the CDT approach, where we had this global time kind of foliation, we were always imagining this spatial universe as being kind of connected. So the question is it, can one solve the model if we allow more general processes here? So I have here a kind of situation where we have a spatial universe. It propagates in proper time. But at some point here, there's another universe, and they merge here to one universe here. Then it splits up here into two universes. And then you see merging and splitting and disappearing eventually also in the vacuum. All of these processes, can they be included? Because, well, you could say that I don't want to include them, but in a quantum theory, it is not unnatural to allow such processes to occur. And of course, in thinking about string theory, these are kind of natural kind of processes. Again, in quantum gravity, there's nothing that dictates us if we should include or not include these processes. I mean, it's in a way, since we don't have really a theory of quantum gravity, it's still our choice whether to include them or not. So here I want to include them and see what kind of whether one can solve this model explicitly too.
There are some arguments why you might have to include them.
Yeah, but you give arguments. I mean, I don't know how strong they are, but I believe there are some arguments that one might or might not think are compelling. But anyway, I want to include them here. So thinking about this in a kind of Lorentzian way, then what is happening here is, so we have here a well-defined Lyapunov structure until we reach such a point where the Lyapunov structure has to be kind of degenerate. So in a way, this kind of splitting has a diffeomorphism right, meaning in a Lorentzian signature. And we can thus introduce a new configuration G for this, for splitting and merging. Of course, a process like this and this doesn't have a topological meaning if you take Euclidean space. Only a combined result of this will have a kind of topological meaning. But nevertheless, since our starting point was kind of Lorentzian, it makes sense to introduce a new coupling constant G for this splitting, and this is of course almost like a straight coupling constant. So the spatial string here splits into two here, and it joins to it.
Can I ask another question?
What
happens if you Fourier transform the propagator into momentum space? Can you see that you're deriving unitarity from the probability?
No, well, here we don't really have too much momentum space because we are in higher dimensions, so space is just kind of one dimensional, and the only variable we have for space is the links. We only dealing with diffeomorphism in random quantities, so we have only the links of this. So in fact, if you insist on a proper time, you and an ADM decomposition, you are really forced to deal with such kind of string field theory if you want to include all geometries. Like the ones I mentioned here. And it was realized many years ago by Sebastian Kawai, and they actually developed a string field theory for increasing quantum gravity, exactly taking such changes into account. So you now have your spatial universe, and you allow two spatial universes to merge. You also allow a spatial universe to disappear, and you allow them to split. So what you need is a third quantization of gravity, you can say, maybe. So you need operators to create and annihilate universes. So you start out with saying that you have a vacuum, and you have a operator psi dagger, which creates a universe, a spatial universe of length L. And similar, you have an operator psi, which annihilates such a spatial universe. And they act on the vacuum in the following way. So if you have a complete set of Calvet functions on your Hilbert space, your spatial Hilbert space, which we have already discussed, where we have this Hamiltonian H0, then you can expand this in terms of these wave functions, and coefficients here, which now becomes operators, satisfying to satisfy. So you see that what you're doing here is exactly what you would do in many body theories. You have a single particle Hamiltonian, H0, and you want to discuss kind of multi-particle states and processes involving many particles, where particles can disappear and be created if you have a chemical potential for that. So you would exactly do something like that. You would create, so that what you would call second quantization in ordinary statistical mechanics. And now our Hamiltonian, our single particle, or here single universe, spatial universe Hamiltonian, in this second quantized form, is can now be written like this. So this is kind of similar, and our propagator from before can be written in this way here. So you see what is happening here is that we act on this vacuum, and a universe, it creates a universe of length L1. This is now propagated here by this single particle, single universe Hamiltonian. So kind of nothing happens exactly, except what I showed before, that it wiggles and so on, but it doesn't branch off in any way. And then at a later time, L2, it is annealing, and that is the attitude. So this is just a second quantized version of this. But now, once we have formulated this, it is easy to write down actually the string field Hamiltonian. This allows for processes of creating and annihilating universes. So here I'm just repeating this.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
I mean, in the picture you showed, the space time was connected, even though the individual slices were not necessarily connected.
Yeah.
But this doesn't seem to have such a requirement built in.
No.
But then I don't know what is the meaning of time. So, I mean, you have this Hamiltonian, you want to say at a certain time, yeah. a new component of the universe came
into
being.
There are many interesting aspects there, indeed, and I'll be happy to discuss some of them with you. Here in the end, we will only be interested in the connected component.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
there are indeed many. I can mention on the blackboard many of the starting mind-boggling aspects that you get into. But yes, it is indeed an issue how to think about this. But again, if you're simple-minded, you just use this Hamiltonian and a time t.
Yeah.
Okay. So you see the processes here are very simple. So you have a universe of length L1 plus L2. And you allow it to split, so this is a spatial universe, so it's really aligned like this. And you allow it to split in two universes of L1 and L2 with a coupling constant G. And similar to other processes, then you allow them to merge and with a coupling constant G again. So I put in here an additional factor alpha in order to be able to kind of distinguish these two processes, but in fact, I want alpha to be equal to 1 in the end. But I put this in for convenience, and put it like this, and then we allow a universe to disappear into nothing, but only if it has length n equal to 0. When it has already contracted to n equal to 0, it's allowed to disappear, but not if the length is equal to 0. So it is the model, strength field model.
What was that third? Is that some source term? What is that last term?
Yeah. So the last term here is that if a universe has contracted into length,
that's it.
So this is just saying that it's into a point, it's contracted into a point. So
how does it force that it's for all finite?
No. So the weight is a delta function.
I see.
So this term.
L is a delta function.
So only when L is equal to 0 is allowed to disappear. You cannot have a universe of finite length, which will disappear. So there.
DL over L times a delta function.
So the point is. So the point is just to have this process to occur, that the universe stops propagating in time. That's it. So the 1 over L is. Put into the commutator of science like that, or there's a one over L also. So it fits. So it's okay.
Why does the word string come into a string filter?
Well, it's a word sheet like a string, and the processes are like in string theory, exactly like in string theory. And in fact, this is exactly what you want to do in string theory, and what you do, that you have your wave function for your spatial for your loops. And they should join with some vertex, they should be able to split. So it is a term of string theory. Where they're not really giving, you only considering the diffeomorphism invariant version of this, so there's no real wave functions on this line L. You know, on the string theory, you can have a map of it. Even there, so you have an optional wave function. So it's much more complicated. But this is in a way a big version of string theory. So what I want to emphasize here, I'm running a bit short of time. So this string theory is defined in this way. In principle, of course, we have a Hamiltonian, but nevertheless, it's a little bit unwieldy. So it's defined as a perturbation theory, and for fixed genus, actually, you can show that it's converging. But the complete series is only an asymptotic series. But we will try to go beyond this. So there are a number of objects you can calculate in this string theory. There are many objects, but some of them are simpler than others. And here is a simple object, which I call a kind of generalized Hartree-Hawking wave function. So what is happening here is at time zero, you're creating a bunch of kind of disconnected universes of length L1 up to Ln. Then they are allowed to propagate in all possible ways, merge, split up, but eventually they will disappear into the vacuum. So So we are considering a process like this, which this graph I showed you already here. So this is an example where we have two universes created at time zero. They propagate, then they merge, then one of them split up here, they merge again, split up, and eventually they disappear. So it's an amplitude like this that we calculate. And to avoid being confused with the time, we are considering the connected component of this. But still, there are very interesting aspects.
Sorry, talk yourself.
Even the simplest situation. So let me just draw it like this, and let me draw it like this. So let's not change topology or anything fancy. Let's just consider this amplitude, and let's say that this time from proper time from here to here is t1, and from here to here is t2. So you follow the time slicing until you reach. So here, you follow the time slicing until you reach to here. And then you see that you have a cap on top of it, like the kind of 1-point function. Now, as Rafael correctly said, so what is, are there really, and how do we know that we start at T2 here and T1 here, and what do you think? Because I have, in fact, already rotated to a Euclidean space, I could have done this, I could have forgotten about that I started here, and instead I could say, I just go on happily, propagating in time, until I reach this point here. Then I would have a situation like this, and I would have another cap here. So this cap would be different from this cap here. And this total time here would be T1 plus T2. And since we have rotated to a Euclidean space, there's nothing telling me that I shouldn't continue here until I reach this thing here. So are they the same or are they different? Or what is the meaning of this? And in fact, you can show analytically by calculation that indeed this amplitude only depends on T1 plus T2. So it doesn't matter. One should only count the surfaces. Kind of one. You could say, but look, I mean, I can easily find a surface here which is different from these, but we should remember that we should sum over all possible caps here. I mean, because it's the quantum amplitude that we have here, so we sum over everything. And when you do that, it turns out that the result is only from 31. And you can put up, if you have 3 universes, 4 universes, you can put up consistent simulations kind of like this. So it's, and they're all satisfied by reasons that probably shows that our calculations are healthy, but they are somewhat mind-boggling.
It depends on so this is under the restriction that there's one of these, I would call them Morse points, or these points where the topology changes. You're not summing over.
I'm summing over
every intermediate.
I'm summing over everything here, except that the total topology is that of a Cauchy lemma. That's the only restriction.
That of a what?
I just didn't
hear the word.
That the topology here is fixed. In this case here, to be that of a it clearly has the topology of the Cauchy lemma, that you have a loop here. You have 2 loops. So it's a Bendit kind of, it's a Bendit cylinder.
What's the word you said?
It's a Bendit cylinder.
That sounds right. Yeah. So I mean, but the fact that it's bent is the fact that you have this special point.
Yeah.
So when you say that it depends only on T1 plus T2,
yeah,
it's under the assumption that you have that point. I mean, you're not including the other metrics where there is no topology change point.
I'm just saying that if this. Well, we're getting distracted. Let's discuss it afterwards.
Okay.
But there are many interesting games you can play. But never mind, so you have this object here, which is a kind of generalization where you have n loops of this thing. You can have a platform from these guys if you want. And then you can derive Dirichlet-Schwinger equations for these objects. So you get an infinite set of coupled equations, as you usually do with Dirichlet-Schwinger equations. Kind of relating the one-point function here with one argument to the one with two arguments, and the one with two arguments to the one with three arguments and one argument. And so it's a set of equations which can be solved perturbatively in G, the coupling function G, can be solved by iteration. So you see here that if you say G equals zero, then this is a you can solve for this. I already did that. This is just the exponential e to the minus square root of lambda times some function of this in L space and the Laplace transform here. So you can solve here. Then to first order G, you solve here, and you use this function here. So all the other functions will be of higher order than G, and in this way you can solve it. So this is standard with the Dirichlet-Schwinger equation. So you get such complicated infinite set of equations. Now, these set of equations can be reproduced exactly by a matrix model. So let me remind you about matrix models. So suppose that you have a potential here of a Hermitian matrix. Then you can form the following matrix integral. You integrate all the Hermitian matrices. You have some observables of the matrices, and you define the expectation value to be this thing. Now, in the old days, matrix models were used to describe exactly these triangulated surfaces, and the corresponding n loop function, where these are the boundary cosmological constants of the n loops, have this kind of representation in the matrix theory. So this is the connected part, and these are traces of x1 minus n, etc. So it was a kind of standard result that in Euclidean quantum gravity, one could define these loop n loop functions, or also they're called general hyperbolic wave functions, in precisely this way here. Now, from these matrix problems, these so-called loop equations one could derive there, they are kind of standard. I will kind of reproduce them for you. But I'll just say to you that if we use this potential here, this matrix potential here, and alpha from the former equations equal to 1 over n squared, if we do that, then we get exactly the same Dirichlet-Schwinger equations as we got here.
So alpha is the difference between creation and annihilation?
So here it appears just as, so in these equations it just appears as a parameter, and we are interested in putting alpha equal to 1. Mm-hmm. Now, in the matrix models, if we put alpha equal to 1 over n squared, then we get exactly the same Dirichlet-Schwinger equations. Like this. So how did one solve these matrix models in the old days? Well, one took n to infinity, actually. And then you see, if you use a potential like this, then these matrix integrals are not really defined, because this potential is unbounded from below, and the eigenvalues of the matrix can take any value, so it's simply not defined. But when you take n to infinity, what happens is that the support of the eigenvalues of the matrices become compact. And then it doesn't matter what potential. So if you really put n to infinity, then it doesn't matter what potential you put in here. This integral is still defined. And then what you did in the old days, So this n was exactly associated with the genus expansion of our surfaces. And this is also the case here. I should say that. Maybe I forgot to emphasize this. So if we look at this thing here, then you see that there's an alpha associated with this point here, and there's an alpha associated with this point here. So this is exactly where the genus of the surface changes. So in fact, this alpha also in the string field theory is associated with the genus expansion. So it's exactly like in the case of the matrix model. But now we actually want to put n, capital N equal to 1, because it is a model that we want to solve. And we can do that. In fact, there's no problem of going back to the matrix integral and putting n equal to 1. Then this matrix becomes just an ordinary number. But the price you pay, so everything that you do is actually correct there, but the price you pay is that this integral here is no longer well-defined for a potential like this. So you have to define it somehow. So the matrix integral becomes an ordinary integral, but it's no longer a compact machine. You have to define the contours so that it converges. So I've drawn here the two contours which makes this integral kind of converge. And then this integral is just the area function. So there are a number of area functions. So this is one area function. This is another area function. Let me go this way here. And they all have they're both complex. If you want the result to be real, we have to add these two, kind of these two contours, or we have to subtract it. Here I have added it, and we get this area function here called bi. Okay. And it's all, so the amplitude now becomes a function of this dimensionless coupling constant here, which is g, the strength coupling constant, which has dimension 3 in this case here, and the cosmological constant, which has dimension 2. So it's all a function of this thing here. So now we have actually found here the partition function to all orders in the coupling constant. Kind of remarkable. And one can then calculate these correlators. So before this was a trace of matrices, now it just becomes a number here. We can represent it like this when x, the boundary cosmological constant, is sufficiently large. We can, because of this choice of contour, m, the real part of m will never be very large. So we can represent it like this. And then it's written explicitly like this. But this is just the Laplace transform of something. So we know this function here. So this is a Hawking wave function, and we are now calculating the summing over all genus for a given length of the boundary here. It simply looks like this. And it satisfies this function here, the Laplace transform, satisfies the following differential equation here. So I'll come back to that in a second. I'm sorry, I'm running. So now, how does the plastic, so until now, I just solved this model explicitly, and I solved it by mapping it into a matrix model. I mentioned nothing about stochastic quantization. So now I come to stochastic quantization. So let me just, so do I have 5 minutes more? Okay. So let me now remind you about stochastic quantization. So the Langevin equation is the following. You have a stochastic variable as a function of stochastic time t, and you have some action s, and then you have a noise term here. So if you didn't have the noise term here, then this would just follow an evolution, so it goes to a local minimum of the action, or if the action is unbounded, it can run away. But that's the destiny of this thing here. However, if you add a noise term, a Gaussian noise term of unit strength, and then the strength is this spherical omega here, if you add that, it will be kicked around. So if it erodes to the minimum, but then it will be kicked around there. And this means that there is a probability distribution. You start out at x, and then if it were just for the classical equation, you were sure to end up at a specific point y, by just solving this first order differential equation. But now, because of the noise term, it can end up in a number of ways. And the expectation value of this gives you the probability distribution. And this probability distribution is satisfied from a Planck equation. I've written it down here. And usually you see it written as a derivative in y. So this prime of x means the derivative of the probability distribution with respect to x. But usually you see there's no prime, and you see it as a derivative with respect to y. But I do that to compare with our quantum gravity case. So if the noise term was not there, we just had this classical equation. And now you can look at that and compare it to the ADM CDT before we allowed the splitting of space and time. Then it satisfied the following equation here, where this S was x cubed times lambda. So we now see that this is like the classical part of the stochastic equation, because the solution to this is just a delta function, where this classical x-classical satisfies this equation, but we need to check that. And our solution that we found, this CDT solution, can be written in the following way. So this doesn't look like a delta function, like here, but it is, in fact, because really what we want to start out with is a delta function in L, in the length of the boundaries, L minus L prime, and the Laplace transform of this delta function is just 1 over x plus 1. So you see that this is not a delta function, but the Laplace transform of the delta, as it should be. So these situations are really extremely similar, and in this way, when you see that our CDT, our starting CDT, is really a classical part, and we can now stochastic quantize it by adding, if you go back and look at this equation here, you see that the stochastic quantization of the Fokker-Planck just comes from adding to this term the noise term here. So you have a first order derivative here, but you add a second order derivative. So we do that. And then we have to formally stochastic quantize the theory. And then the stochastic quantized theory would satisfy the following equation here. And now if you choose omega equal to 2g, what happens here is that we have perturbative agreement with our kind of non-perturbative function here, and also any perturbative expansion of the CTT string field theory. So this equation here, in one go, actually agrees with the string field theory. So, but now we have a closed equation here for solving this. So stochastic quantization provides us with a closed equation for the string field theory for the two-point function. And if we make so one can easily, by taking y to infinity, one can kind of reproduce the Carbonne-Bond function, and this equation here goes over into the following equation, which I showed you before. You see, we have this equation. So this was found from the string field theory just by brute force calculation, but now stochastic quantization, it seems to give us exactly the same thing. And now one can just classify this to see what does it look like in L space. And we now get a Hamiltonian. So before we had this Hamiltonian, just this thing. And what is added now is a term, very simple term, just G L squared is added to it. And our the platform of this, the V of L, is satisfied the relativity equation. So before the W naught satisfy that H naught W naught is equal to zero. Now this Hamiltonian actually satisfies for you, if you take this complicated V of L here in terms of the Erik functions, it satisfies exactly this differential equation. So our solution is indeed corresponding to this kind of stochastic quantization. So let us try to understand what this Hamiltonian is really. So it has a little bit of a non-canonical form with this factor L in front, and L is of course only positive here. So it leaves on the half line. But we can make a transformation L equal to 1/2 z squared, then this Hamiltonian becomes of a canonical form. And you see that it has a potential here. It's repelled at z equal to 0. That is L equal to 0. Then it's quadratic. But then it is unbounded from below. So before we had these exponential polynomial Carvey functions, they're drawn here. And now they follow up exponentially here. But out here, suddenly, they change to oscillating series. And this can be calculated in the WKD approximation very easily. So the outer, so of course, this the amplitude here is exponentially small, but still it oscillates rather than falling off. So now we can be afraid of such unbounded Hamiltonians. But it turns out that, so before the spectrum was discrete, it turns out that this Hamiltonian still has a discrete spectrum. So it is unbounded, and it turns out that Hamiltonians, unbounded Hamiltonians, actually they have discrete spectrum if the classical escape velocity to infinity is finite. Then they act very much like a finite Born potential, and they have self-adjoint extensions. And these self-adjoint extensions, they have discrete eigenvalues.
There must be many self-adjoint.
There's a one parameter self-adjoint. Yes, that's right.
But they all have discrete.
They're all discrete. They're all discrete. We will choose one in a moment. So the energy spectrum is discrete as before. But actually, there's a drastic change of wave functions. So before, the expectation value of the universe was simply 1 over square root of lambda. But now it's infinite, exactly because of this tail here. So this tail makes the extreme value infinite. So in here, the probability of finding a universe is almost unchanged. But if you calculate the expectation value, it changes. So and this is come from the summation of all general. So one way to better understand the property of the Hamiltonian is to return to this X representation. So here we have, and now Laplace transform back. So here was our original Hamiltonian given by this, and then we have this term here. This is coming from the noise term. This is just the second derivative coming from the noise term. So this Hamiltonian viewing X as a real variable is not self-adjoint, and that's typical for stochastic processes. The Hamiltonians there are not, when you just write them down, they're usually not self-adjoint. But in these cases, there's always a formal similarity transformation written this way here. This brings us to a Hamiltonian missing self-adjoint. So if we apply this transformation, we get the following Hamiltonian. So this is a Hamiltonian which formally has the same eigenvalues as this. And the potential is now just a double well potential. It's slightly displaced. And the spectrum of this Hamiltonian is now well defined, is discrete, unambiguous, and positive. In fact, H can be written as R dagger times R, where R is this kind of differential operator. So in this way, you can say that the standard formulation of stochastic quantization has provided us with a number term definition of string theory. And the time which appears here is exactly the proper time in our quantum theory. So this is what is very unusual in this thing here, because usually, of course, you might recall that stochastic quantization is just an equivalent way of quantizing series. You can do that. But there, the stochastic time has no role. So you kind of recover your continuum quantum field theory by taking this stochastic time to infinity. I mean, then the correlators there, they converge to the underlying, so the stochastic quantization lives in D plus one dimension, and the D dimensional theories are recovered when you take the stochastic time to infinity as the kind of equilibrium property of the correlators. But it's not here. Here, the stochastic time here is really the proper time of our underlying theory. So I should say that this observation is unfortunately not mine, but it is made by Sebastian Kawai, as I said, already 15 years ago. And I think the reason that not more attention was paid to it was that it was made exactly at the time when the second string revolution took place, and Kawaii, he turns his attention to the second string revolution and the IKKT model of normativity, the string theory. But actually, I think it's a very interesting observation. And here, in this formulation here, it is much clearer than the original work of Bashir and Kawaii, because in fact, they didn't have a H naught. So everything here is governed by H naught. We expand H naught is a classical theory, so to speak. But they didn't have an H naught. And they couldn't use it for anything. They just made the observation that in fact, the stochastic time is proper time. So one can really ask here, how is it possible that an intrinsic time, proper time, in our worship becomes extrinsic, like stochastic time? It is maybe where an interesting lesson can be learned here. Maybe the extrinsic nature of space and time is inherently contrary. So I will mention here an example. So I use Euclidean quantum gravity rather than the KCGT, where space and time are treated kind of equivalently. So how would we define distance at all in a quantum theory? So the only way I know how to think about it is via correlators. So let us assume that we have quantum gravity coupled to a field. And now let us define a correlator. But it has to be a diffeomorphism inverse correlator to make sense. So here is a definition, the only one I know of a diffeomorphism inverse correlator of a simple scalar field. So we integrate all matrix, we integrate all field configurations, we use the action. And then we cannot use psi of chi 1, psi of chi 2, because that doesn't have a diffeomorphism inverse meaning. We have to integrate all positions there. But we need some well-defined separation in order to talk about a correlator. So we put in a delta function, saying that the gate distance in the given metric g should be separated by r. So you see that in this way, the intrinsic geodesic distance becomes kind of related to the extrinsic parameter r. So this r is a proper time, so to speak, or a proper distance in the quantum theory. But we have to put it in outside the past integral in order to make sense of this. So it becomes an external parameter. It's referring to no specific geometry. Even if at the same time all geodesic distances in the geometries in the past integral are referring to this distance. So in this way, if you really want to define distance and time in quantum gravity, they seem to be external parameters. And that's why that kind of stochastic time can enter here. This comes out of explicit calculations here in the 2D models. But of course, one could always hope that this general message is sent to us from these vision models. So thank you very much for your patience.
Any questions?
One question. The two stochastic, the Fokker-Planck equation, you can refer to Brownian motion, which is not strictly quantum. How do you know that this is a quantum fluctuation?
Well, I rotate it to a Euclidean space. There it is. It's the same.
So, Raphael? Well, yeah, I was confused. It's the final Hamiltonian you wrote down. But I was always wondering why there was an H naught, a zero on the H naught. So, in the end, we found out. In that final Hamiltonian that you wrote down, there's only a length, as far as I understood. Yeah, this, I guess if you go back.
Yeah. Yes. It's a Hamiltonian acting on spatial geometries.
But it just looks like one spatial geometry. I mean, what if there's something that I didn't follow in the whole thing, but you got this by allowing for the topology changes. what has happened to the topology change in this wave function? Shouldn't there be many components? Or why are there, why is there only one component, apparently?
Well, so, this H, yeah, okay. So this H is referring to this two-point function. So it is interesting to refer to this two-point function. So this two-point function has
so that two-point function assumes that you have, so would there be another H for, suppose you had another two-point function, you might call it three-point function.
Well, so this H is only, this is only associated with this operator here, where you have an exit loop and an entrance loop. So this H parametrically can describe the propagation from, if you go to the blackboard here, from here to here, can no matter what happens in between.
Yeah, it looks as if it doesn't. I mean, it's collapsing. All the topology changes that have happened, it's somehow collapsing into a potential that's a function of L.
Yeah,
that's kind of remarkable or it's unbelievable or something.
It's absolutely remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. Yeah, I think so all these topology changes, everything is just included in this term. That's all.
But it's not all the topology change, which you're including here is just, you know, instead of just looking at cylinders, you're saying, okay, there's also the cylinder which is curved, and then you have the next amplitude, which is proportional to L, so that two cylinders glue together, which is these guys.
But you can and also split in between.
No, they don't split in between.
No, here.
It's just that, it's just this picture here. So you have added one term that. Well.
I mean, this H is describing the propagation from here to here, but including all kinds of outflows, topology changes, and everything. And this is done simply by adding this additional term. It is, of course, what it shows that the model is very simple. And of course, you can now ask exactly what is this model, because,
So I don't understand then why such a section would be a unitary model, because it would not be in any fit theory. I mean, so where do you find unitarity if you do this restriction? You're setting the subsector, which is very easy, the subsector where you're restrict only at one state is by itself a unitary object.
Well,
and that's very strange.
I'm just saying a trivial thing here. So I have not mentioned unitarity or anything, but if you have a self-adjoint Hamiltonian and the evolution is given by E to I T times H, this is what you call a.
Yeah, so here you have unitarity, but you see, it doesn't fit with this picture to say that there are states in between in and out, which are very different from the one you put. Because if I do the cut rule, then I have, you know, the one evolution plus some other things.
What I'm telling you is that in this model, all these things are captured by this term.
But the question is how do you think of this Hamiltonian?
Yes.
Is it just a mathematical device that in the end will compute for you this two-point function, and without take seriously any of the intermediate configurations that it seems to be talking about?
What you can do is, of course, that you can put, you, since you know what, I mean, you can develop, you have the US strength theory, which reproduces these results, of course, conservatively. So you know, in terms of this copy across the G, what surfaces to associate with this. So for each order, you can make a conservative expansion and you can identify the corresponding diagrams.
Uh-huh.
So that you can do. So in this way you can create a space-time feature if you want. But how it managed to.
I mean, this is a kind of space-time picture too, but it's not the same. It's a very different picture.
It's
a picture in which this, you have a circle and it's oscillating in size, and
so
it's running off to infinity and bouncing off infinity.
So the fact, so well, I wouldn't say that I have a clear understanding on it, but the fact that this change here is taking place is for me a kind of reflection of the fact that while you have an exit loop, entrance loop and an exit loop, then when you cut it like this, the effective length of all the universe somehow is much larger, because this L must somehow count. The other universe. That's my interpretation. But I haven't.
I think one way of getting at making it a little more concrete is, what's the significance of this parameter and the self-adjoint extension? What's the physical significance? Or can you relate that to something as a string theory, field theory, or something?
Well, no. I think that. You see, there is, and this has been a nightmare in all. This is a problem in all string theories, even in critical string theories, of course. That the summation of all genus, we don't know what it is. I mean, we have the perturbative series, and that we have here too. So at the moment that we make a non-perturbative series,
so you found a sort of non-perturbative parameter.
I found
string theory.
Well, this is not string theory. This is non-critical.
Zero dimensional.
Yeah. But you know, it was known.
Saying that's bad.
No, it is bad. It is bad.
But why is it bad?
Well, because we want to find.
But there's a physical.
By physical arguments.
That's not a problem, actually.
By physical arguments, I mean, we want to argue for the unique non-perturbative solution. And Cabanto don't have any physical arguments. Then you're left a little bit in range. So it is a whole problem, actually. So let us go back. It's basically illustrated the thing.
This is an ambiguity just for the 1-1.
Yeah.
There would be an ambiguity for the 1-2.
So.
Well, that's a question. Will there be a connection? That's a good question. Will there be a
connection? So it is.
It's not clear that there would be.
No.
So it is. You see, the ambiguity, there's already ambiguity here.
Yes.
You know, because you have to choose a contour, and you have to use a principle for choosing a contour. Well, you want the interval to be well defined. So whenever you expand this, you can make a transformation of this. You have an m squared, just shift m by a constant, then you get m squared and m cubed. So, and then you simply leave the Gaussian term. This gives, and you power expand the m cubed term.
Okay.
Then you have a perturbative expansion, right. A well defined perturbative expansion. And that, of course, exactly agrees with the string field theory that we already have to find.
Okay.
Now, if you want to lift it to a higher level of being non-perturbative, then you can either do it like I've done here, and
this is a discrete ambiguity, it's not a continuous ambiguity.
Right.
So that's not the same ambiguity.
Well, you can take any no, sure, but you can take any linear combination of these contours, and
what's the linear combination?
They will provide you with a definition which only differs as 1 over g squared terms. E to the 1 over g.
Then if you put x1, xn for endpoint function, then this is n multilinear un times this.
So the only thing I want to say is the ambiguity is already here. I have got rid of it by claiming that this should be real. The partition function should be here. But if you want to drop that requirement, then you have many choices. And it's not really, you would like it to be real, but it's not a deep physical kind of requirement. In fact, if it was complex, you would say that, maybe it signals that something should be added to the model to make it a better model. I mean, one can take many attitudes here. And exactly this problem was also present in the old non-critical string series, just in a more complicated setting, that when you wanted to, what you wrote down there was exactly a differential equation for the amplitude partition function sum over all g. But this differential equation had in fact a solution So the, it was an inhomogeneous equation, and it has a solution which was interpreted in the string coupling constant. But then it had homogeneous solutions, which were like 1 over g. So you could add, you could add any of these, and you wouldn't know. There was no guiding principle to decide what to choose. And we are in the same situation here. So unfortunately, I haven't defined. So what I have done is the following. I have shown that if you think about this in terms of stochastic quantization, then there is F prescription, namely this similarity transformation, which brings you to a Hamiltonian, which is unambiguous. But whether you would
it's unambiguous, but it has many self-adjoined extensions.
No.
So it's completely unambiguous.
This is one of them.
That's one. It chooses one of the self-adjoined. Yeah, I didn't understand.
But it's of course chosen arbitrarily in the sense that it is using the stochastic quantization to argue for this. But you see, again, if you look into the dirty details of this, unfortunately, life is not so simple because. Let's go to it here. Oops, that was. Well, you see, this prescription, this similarity transformation, is strictly speaking only really mathematically defined if this S is a good action bounded from below. Mm-hmm. And now this S is unfortunately not a good action bounded from below, because it was a phi cube potential. So this is formal. It's entirely a formal. So I just followed the formal which is just transition, shoving under the rock, that indeed, I would have said it if I had time, but I was not going to run in this one.
We all believe that.
No, but I don't want friends here, so we just saw the reason.
Historically, the reason we don't do string field theory, I mean, let's go to string theory in 10 dimensions. Historically, the reason is that we want a string field theory because you want to get the theory off the mesh shell when you do particle physics or something. And the reason it didn't work is because of the 25 years ago, Witten showed that the theory is a phi cube theory. The Hamiltonian is always unbounded from below. It's an unstable theory. And no one's ever been able to solve that problem, as far as I know.
Well, there are several things to be said about that. I think when you go to the superstring theory, it's not really like that, but it's true for the bosonic spring theory. But for the superstring theory, it is actually bounded. But still, it hasn't helped us to. I mean, still, string field theory as defined there is just a perturbative. It's just perturbative in the string coupling. I mean, when you have a Hamiltonian, but you don't know how to deal with it, so the only way you know what to do with it.
It's also non-local.
Yeah, it's very.
You should have an exponential of derivatives.
Anyway, here, there is indeed this ambiguity, and this is an old story. We haven't improved on that compared to the old days of non-critical string theory. But what is the difference here is actually that this stochastic quantization, the time there, is the proper time the geodesic distance disappears, is manifest here, but it was not that anymore. So Kawai and his Bashi had this conjecture, and they proved it in one particular model that they discussed in detail. So here is another model where you can see it explicitly.
I mean, they conjectured that their time was.
Well, yeah.
That the stochastic time was.
Yeah.
Should be thought of as proper time. Was that?
So actually, it's slightly on. In the real kidding of gravity and not the CDT, it is actually slightly more subtle because the proper time there has scales enormous. It has dimension not of length, but the scale of length. So it was a non-trivial statement there. So since there are only a finite number of solvable exact models, what is this model in terms of repeating quantum gravity? And I can tell you what it is. It is C equal to minus 2. So C equal to minus 2 is what is in the old age was called kind of topological gravity. And this is, in fact, topological gravity. The equilibrium exponent, well, so what this is, so topological gravity in the old days was a nightmare because it was very difficult to define, but nevertheless, there were several kind of definitions of it, but what this is actually a kind of explicit surface representation of topological gravity. So it gives the same critical exponents as topological gravity. So it is probably fully diffeomorphic invariant, the single and silver, but it doesn't help us solve the conceptual issue, but it gives evidence to the fact that this time
it gives evidence to the CDT might be able to avoid breaking diffeomorphism.
Yeah, I think we should
finish. Yeah, so, okay. Thank you, Jan, again.